All right. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Ron Park on behalf of the appellant, Arthur Soucy. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, 3 minutes. Sorry. All right. It's all right. Basic math. Here we go.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. On January 24, 2014, Mr. Soucy walked into Dr. Gilbertson's chiropractic clinic, and he was carried out by EMTs. In between, Dr. Gilbertson attempted a chiropractic maneuver called the crane condyle lift, and at the time he performed it, Mr. Soucy and Dr. Gilbertson were the only ones in the room, and because the maneuver is performed on the head and neck, Mr. Soucy couldn't see what was being done to him. Now, immediately after Dr. Gilbertson attempted the lift, Mr. Soucy felt tears in his neck, and he felt woozy upon getting up.
He could feel what was being done to him, though, right?
He could feel what was being done to
him. Is that relevant?
It's not complete, Your Honor, because while he might have been able to feel the force and testify as to how much force he felt, a chiropractic maneuver is not just the application of force. It's an application of force in a certain manner. And so, for example, the crane condyle lift requires practice and training. And so just because Mr. Soucy could say at trial that, you know, I felt the force, it felt similar to something I had experienced before, well, he had never felt the crane condyle lift having been done to him before that. It was the first time Mr. Soucy had received that maneuver. And so I don't think it's a complete explanation for whether or not Dr. Gilbertson performed the maneuver correctly.
But if you could give a complete description of how what he remembered mm-hmm. happening to him to an expert, is that still not relevant?
I still don't think so, Your Honor, because he can't exactly see how Dr. Gilbertson is using his hands, how he's being manipulated. He can try to say as best he can, you know, my head was tilted this way, I felt the twist, but I really do think you need to see it being done, and that's because we did have chiropractic experts at trial, Your Honor, and the reality is, you know, when you're questioning them, did Dr. Gilbertson do this correctly? What did he do wrong? The experts were largely at a loss. They could not say exactly whether or not Dr. Gilbertson performed it correctly. And so I do think this takes us into the res ipsa field, where basically the evidence of negligence, such as there is uniquely in the hands of the defendant, such that the plaintiff really has no way of proving his case as he ordinarily would, and he really needs the benefit of the instruction. Now, of course, the jury doesn't need to make that inference. It's up to the jury whether they decide that, considering all the circumstances, there is an inference of negligence there. But ultimately, that's a jury question. Now, certainly, Dr. Gilbertson can come forward and try to give alternative explanations, which he did, which is this idea that Mr. Soucy had a pre-existing condition in his vertebral arteries. But even that evidence, Your Honor, was not undisputed. And
a quick question about terminology. Yes. Are vertebral vessels or vertebral arteries the same as precerebral arteries? Are those synonymous?
Yes. To my understanding, they are. At least they're sufficiently synonymous for purposes of this appeal. They're the arteries that run from the heart up through the neck into the brain, as opposed to the renal arteries, where there was medical evidence in that respect that he had FMD in the renal arteries. But just because he had the FMD in the renal arteries doesn't mean that he had it necessarily in the vertebral arteries. And if you look at the medical records, Your Honor, Dr. Lukoski, who was Mr. Soucy's treating vascular neurologist, acknowledged that there was FMD in the renal arteries, but he did not see any FMD in the precerebral vessels or the vertebral arteries. He testified as much at trial as well, and he was not the only one, Your Honor. There are other radiologists that also examined Mr. Soucy's angiograms, also did not find any FMD. And, of course, the defense came forward with an expert who did find it, but, of course, that just creates a jury question. The jury decides whether or not they're going to credit one evidence or one testimony over another. And, frankly, you know, without the res ipsa instruction, Mr. Soucy was prejudiced because he could not affirmatively show exactly what it was that Dr. Gilbertson did wrong. And I think this is consistent with what the Supreme Court has held, I think, for the last several decades, which is that if there is a dispute as to what exactly caused the injury, well, then that's a matter that goes to the jury. The jury decides, and it's only in a situation where the evidence is so conclusive that no other inference is possible that we, deny the res ipsa instruction outright. And so I think for this reason, the trial court really committed an error by not giving that instruction. And
I think some of the cases on jury instructions say you have to have substantial evidence to support your jury instruction. is there substantial evidence in this record that there was no pre-existing FMD in the vertebral arteries?
I think so, Your Honor. Mr. Soucy's treating vascular neurologist testifies much. That testimony is consistent with his notes in his medical records at the time he was treating Mr. Soucy. As part of his job as a doctor, he would have been trying to look for these pre-existing conditions because he doesn't want to see whether there is a risk of further dissections or other complications down the line. And the entire medical team who was there, the other radiologists, other doctors, they also did not find any FMD in the vertebral arteries. So I do think that creates substantial evidence that he did not have this pre-existing condition. Despite the fact that maybe there was, the defense expert says there was, well, you know, that becomes weighing the evidence, and really that's the province of the jury, Your Honor. That's not really something for the trial court to decide. And I do think Younger v. Webster, which is a case from 1973, has a good paragraph about that, which is that the trial court may think that were it sitting as a trier of fact, it would not find in plaintiff's favor. But that's not the question for the trial court. The question really is whether there's a reasonable jury weighing the evidence could come out in favor of the plaintiff. That is, that there are the elements of res ipsa, and that an inference of negligence is tenable on the facts. And for this reason, I think the judgment should be vacated, and this matter should be remanded for a new trial. I'll reserve the remainder for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Dan Lindahl, representing the respondents. And today we'll ask the court to affirm the verdict and resulting judgment in favor of the respondents in this medical malpractice case. The issue, of course, before the court is whether the trial court erred by failing to give plaintiffs requested res ipsa loquitur instruction. And I want to begin with some sort of context, and then we'll move to what I think are the dispositive elements of res ipsa that were not present here and justified the failure to give the instruction. The context is this, of course. The Washington Supreme Court has cautioned repeatedly res ipsa should be applied sparingly only in peculiar and exceptional cases. And this restrictive view makes sense for this reason. It is an extraordinary comment on the evidence. It is telling the jury, you may draw this inference from this circumstantial evidence. That runs against the grain of how we instruct juries. And for that reason, the Supreme Court, again, in the Zukowski case said, such instructions are ordinarily needless, since the jury will consider all evidence not stricken by the court. So we start with that framework. And one other factor I want to note here is this. It matters in what context res ipsa is invoked. It's one thing to invoke it as a evidentiary bridge to allow a plaintiff to survive summary judgment or a directed verdict. And we see that in a lot of the cases. It's quite another to instruct the jury how it should consider the evidence once the plaintiff has reached the jury, as the plaintiff did here. Now, I want to turn to the elements of res ipsa, beginning with, most importantly, I think, the first element. You have the three elements, all must be present. The trial judge must find each one is satisfied. The first element is the accident or occurrence that caused the plaintiff's injury would not ordinarily happen in the absence of negligence. Would not ordinarily happen. I want to focus on that word ordinarily. The issue isn't could this injury have occurred because of negligence. It's not, does it sometimes happen because of negligence? Are there facts from which the judge can say it ordinarily happens? So let's look at this case particular. We all agree.
Well, I think we're skipping a step, aren't we? Because there are three ways to get there under the law, right? There's leaving foreign objects, there's the general experience and observations test, and there's the proof of experts in an esoteric field.
Yes.
And I guess I'm most concerned with that last one.
Mm-hmm.
Do we not have that proof by experts in an esoteric field that creates an inference?
We don't, Your Honor, and this is why. The testimony at trial was that neither a negligent chiropractic adjustment, nor fibromuscular dysplasia ordinarily causes these types of dissections. Both are extraordinary causations. What usually causes them is either some form of blunt force trauma or high blood pressure. So to the whole idea behind res ipsa is that if this thing happens, whether by common sense or by expert instruction, we're told it ordinarily is the result of negligence. Here, this dissection cannot be attributed ordinarily to any of the causes that the parties put before the jury, and it is certainly inappropriate to allow the jury to infer, because this happened, therefore, it was probably negligence on the part of the defendant.
Didn't Mr. Soucy's expert, though, testify that a properly performed occipital lift shouldn't cause this type of arterial dissection?
He did.
So why doesn't that
appear in a healthy person? Yes.
So why and there was disputed. It was disputed whether or not he had FMD in his vertebral arteries.
It was.
So, looking at the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Soucy, why wouldn't this expert opinion regarding the properly performed occipital lift get him there?
Again, you can't get from all that establishes is that it could be caused by this, just as it could be caused by FMD. Neither allows this extraordinary factual inference that we're allowing the jury to draw to say it probably happened. Because it ordinarily happens, if you have this condition, you start with the chiropractic adjustment. Nobody testified to that that's the first place you look. It's simply an alternative. It's one of the causations. The plaintiff was allowed to present that evidence and allowed to present that argument. The plaintiff reached the jury on it, and the jury concluded that that wasn't the cause.
I think I see what you're saying. It sounds like you're essentially taking the position that the expert for the plaintiff just didn't go far enough in the opinion. Okay.
Yeah. This is plaintiff's theory, and if they wanted a res ipsa instruction, they needed to do more than simply do what they did, which was fine. This could have caused it. It can cause it. Now, I want to turn I got a little more time than I thought. I don't think the expert testimony gets us there, and I think it's pretty clear. We can't just fall back on our general experience and common sense. I mean, I'll confess, I'd never heard of this kind of dissection, arterial dissection, until I worked on this case. So it's not that kind of thing. It's not you go in and the dentist drills on the wrong side of your mouth or amputates the wrong member. We can all say, that doesn't make sense. That should never happen. Something went wrong. So the first element of it ordinarily happens in the absence of negligence or does not ordinarily happen isn't satisfied. And then the second element I want to look at is the cause of the plaintiff's injury was in the exclusive control of the defendant. Now, why do we have this element? And again, this instruction is to be given where it is commanded by the interests of justice, I think is the way the Supreme Court has characterized it. And the idea is that there is a complete imbalance in access to information, in access to being able to explain it. The patient who is unconscious during the medical procedure is at a severe disadvantage compared to the person who observes it. Or the cases like the busted water pipe or the dock that the person falls through. The plaintiff isn't even present during the course of maintenance. They have no way to know. Here, first of all, there was abundant objective evidence, particularly in the form of all the images of the plaintiff's neck. Both sides could bring in their doctors. Both sides could analyze that objective evidence. Both sides could develop their theories.
This is the imaging that took place afterwards.
Correct, yes.
How about evidence of what was actually done to Mr. Soucy?
Well, Your Honor, I think you put your finger on that. This patient had more than a decade of chiropractic adjustments with this doctor. He was awake, alert, felt what happened? Can you describe how his head was manipulated? Could he see it? No. But he was not a patient who was unconscious during the course of the proceeding, the adjustment. And he felt, he knew what was happening. He felt and testified to what happened. He testified he felt something went wrong. He testified to how he felt immediately thereafter. So this is not the kind of situation where you have a dramatic imbalance in access to information that justifies the extraordinary res ipsa loquitur instruction, allowing the plaintiff to skip over proving the negligence and causation that is required to prove his case. And then, there's the additional fact that the FMD here was not within the exclusive control of this doctor, of course. That's a disease that is completely outside his control. For these reasons, we ask this court to affirm this jury's verdict after 7 days of testimony, multiple experts found in favor of the defendant, and the judgment should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Parker, Your Honor, just a few points.
If you could focus on this one point made by counsel. Mr. Soucy's chiropractic expert testified, I think, that a properly performed occipital lift should not cause this type of arterial dissection. And they're saying that doesn't get you there. You need more from your expert. What's your response to that?
I don't think you need more. In fact, I don't know what more he could have said. He didn't just say that it should not. I think he said it could not, that a properly performed crane condyle lift cannot cause the sorts of dissections that Mr. Soucy suffered. And that wasn't just Mr. Soucy's expert. I think he got that out of Dr. Gilbertson as well, that it was impossible for a properly performed crane condyle lift to cause the artery dissection, as well as, I believe it was Dr. McKellarin, who was Dr. Gilbertson's chiropractic expert as well. So
did he have to go to the next step, though, and say, and an improperly conducted lift would ordinarily cause this kind of problem?
Well, I believe the first element is the injury does not ordinarily occur absent negligence. So the question really is, okay, he does this properly, would that ordinarily result in an arterial dissection? And I think all experts agree that it doesn't. Now, if he does it improperly, would that ordinarily lead? I think that's a slightly different question, and that's not what's called for by the res ipsa elements. Also, as far as res ipsa merely being a bridge to surviving summary judgment or non-suit, I think that's clearly not the case by the fact that the Washington Supreme Court issues pattern jury instructions on res ipsa loquitur, which means that there are occasions in which it is proper to instruct the jury, and that those instances are when the plaintiff just uniquely isn't in a position to explain what went wrong. And I understand that plaintiff wasn't unconscious like you might be in surgery when you're put under anesthesia, but practically speaking, Mr. Soucy couldn't see what was being done to him. I understand he had some limited ability to feel what was being done to him, but again, that wasn't sufficient for the experts to be able to say, really, one way or the other, whether the lift had been done correctly. I would also note that, again, for 15 years, he was seeing Dr. Gilbertson for treatment, but this is the first time that he had the crane condyle lift done to him. So it really has no point of comparison to say, well, this is different from all the other times. This is the one and only time. And so he was, once again, uniquely disadvantaged, and really, this is the type of situation where the Supreme Court has said that a res ipsa instruction is appropriate, and it should have been given here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you all, and that concludes our session this morning. The court will be in recess.